Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
In the intelligence community, they call it the book. It's a summary of the most important sensitive security issues on the planet delivered daily to the President of the United States and only a handful of others. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. The President's daily brief is so secret that not only are its contents classified, but even information about how many people write it or who was the final editor is secret. Some have described it as the most exclusive newspaper in the world. But we do know it exists, and we can know how it has evolved over time to suit the needs of the country's modern chief executives. Joining us to tell us about the book is David Preece. He provided daily CIA intelligence briefs to Presidents Bill Clinton and George W. Bush, and also served as a desk officer at the State Department. His new book is called The President's Book of Secrets, The Untold Story of Intelligence Briefings to America's Presidents from Kennedy to Obama. David, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. Pleasure to be here.
When I think about being the leader of the free world and about all the thousands of pressing issues that a president has to keep in mind, it's hard to imagine how any mere mortal could keep up. What role does the president's daily brief play?
Well, there's so much information in both the classified and the unclassified world that might pertain to the business of the president of the United States. And the job of this daily book of secrets for the past 50-plus years has been to compile the information that the president needs to know that day and leave out everything the president does not need to know that day to help the president make the national security decisions that are most pressing.
Would the general public be shocked by its contents on a lot of days? How does it compare with the kind of information that the rest of us might access through journalism?
It's the kind of thing that probably would surprise people on both ends. On the one hand, there's information in there that probably describes things much like you would see in some good national security reporting on stations like this one. On the other hand, there is some secret intelligence that gets into the president's daily brief, which is nowhere except in classified information. This might be things from human intelligence sources overseas, that is, the spies. This might be information from classified communications intercepts, that is, phone calls between certain foreign leaders. Whatever it is, that's information you're not going to get in any other place, and it might surprise people just how good that information is on various places around the world.
I was surprised to learn that there's not a standard protocol for who sees the PDB every day other than the president himself.
That's right. That's a decision that is up to every president. And this process goes back to John F. Kennedy, and we'll have some time to talk about the history of this. But each president gets to decide who else gets to see the daily book of secrets. Some have kept it very, very close, a small circle. Others have widened it to dozens of people so that others high up in the administration can see the same secrets that the president is seeing every morning.
Of course, there are some considerations, I would imagine, on the part of the people developing these briefs, this book of secrets. If there are a lot of people, are they self-editing, knowing that maybe things that they only want the president to know shouldn't go in there?
Yeah, there's a real tension there because on the one hand, if the president limits the president's daily brief to just himself and, let's say, the national security advisor, well, then there can be some very sensitive information in there. The material that's printed will only be seen by a few eyes. The downside is the president of the United States and the national security advisor by themselves actually do very little. They guide the machinery of the U.S. government, but in order to take action based on that sensitive information, they need to be able to talk about it and disseminate it. On the other hand, if, of course, the book goes to dozens and dozens of people, then maybe there is some selecting out of the most sensitive things so that the dozens of copies of this book that are floating around do not get picked up by the wrong person or get conflated with other information that can be disseminated more widely. So it does make sense that some of the most sensitive things at that point might be reserved just for a private conversation with the president in the Oval Office and not printed in the book itself.
What happens to expired copies, David? Are they ordered to be shredded? Are they picked back up again?
Yeah, in the research that I did, and I tried to talk to as many people as I could who have touched the president's daily brief or its predecessor document in the last 50-plus years, the majority of them that I spoke with that made comments on this referred to the fact that they are either archived in classified storage space, traditionally at CIA headquarters, and other copies are destroyed according to the methods that classified materials must be destroyed by.
So your subtitle refers to the history of the brief from Kennedy to Obama, but FDR and Truman and Eisenhower had access to what might be considered a nascent form of this. Tell us about how they were updated on intelligence.
Sure. There really was no intelligence analysis function per se before World War II. So Franklin Roosevelt was the first to get what we would call analysis, but even this was ad hoc and spotty, mostly provided by the research and analysis cell of the Office of Strategic Services, much more famous for its covert actions and clandestine operations around the world during World War II. But they did have an analytic function as well. This was not robust, however, and it did largely wither after the Second World War. Harry Truman picked up the presidency, and he did want something that consolidated all of these reports coming to his desk from the various national security agencies. So he ended up getting something called the Daily Summary, and it was a small document, just a few pages, that contained summaries of some of that clandestine reporting, usually from the State Department or from other sources. The problem was it wasn't really personally focused on him. So although he enjoyed it, it was not really catering to his personality and his style of reading. That didn't happen under his predecessor either. For Dwight Eisenhower, he was used to a very rigid set of briefings, military style. And the written product he got, he didn't seem to pay as much attention to, so they merely relied on getting him his intelligence information through National Security Council meetings and other briefings like that.
For President Kennedy, the brief developed into what was called the President's Intelligence Checklist, and it had a funny acronym. What had Kennedy requested from this from his intelligence team?
Yeah, John F. Kennedy came into office, and he had a decidedly different approach to issues than his predecessor, General Eisenhower, did. In fact, some of his advisors had a real hard time with him sitting still for briefings. Some of his advisors said he would rock in his chair and nearly walk out of sessions if they went too long. It was actually 55 years ago today that his national security advisor, McGeorge Bundy, wrote him a very blunt memo that advised him to set aside a real and regular time each day for national security discussions and actions. And he complained in it. McBundy said that Truman and Eisenhower did what he called their daily dozen in foreign affairs the first thing in the morning. And a couple of weeks ago, Kennedy had asked Bundy to begin to meet with him on this basis. McBundy complained that he had succeeded in catching him on only three mornings for a total of about 8 minutes, and therefore concluded this was really not how he liked to begin the day. What ended up happening is instead they just handed Kennedy a huge stack of reports from all the various national security bureaucracies and then found that he didn't go through all that either. So sure enough, they finally called upon the CIA to pull together some kind of digest of information that would fit Kennedy's personality. He liked to read about an issue and then turn immediately to a discussion with an aide, and then maybe hours later he would return to another issue. So they decided to create for him the President's Intelligence Checklist, a small document that could be folded and put into his breast pocket so that he could read something, tuck it away, and then pull it out again later in the day to see what the intelligence issues of the day were.
How did Kennedy's experience with the Bay of Pigs fiasco shape his approach to intelligence?
Sure. It definitely was not a success for the Kennedy administration. He felt that he had relied too much on what he assumed was the expertise of the military and intelligence officials. And he decided after that he needed to be more on top of material. His advisors agreed, and that was part of the reason for the creation of the President's Intelligence Checklist. As you mentioned, it became known pretty widely by its acronym, the PICKLE, and CIA for years was often referred to as the Pickle Factory as a result.
I have to tell you, I was floored by the idea that, vice presidents, if suddenly called to serve as chief executive, often didn't have access to this thing. LBJ found himself unaware that it had even existed at the moment that he took the oath of office.
Right. When Kennedy started getting this PICKLE, he got it. His national security advisor got it, and a few other senior aides that worked directly for him at the White House got it. But even for its first 6 months, that was it. It was only then that Kennedy realized, as he was tasking things out to his Secretary of State and his Secretary of Defense, they had no idea what he was reacting to. So within about 6 months, he did clue in the Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense. But that did not include the Vice President of the United States. In fact, one of the lead CIA officers involved in producing this document asked a senior White House national security aide, "What about the Vice President?" And the answer was firm and final, under no circumstances. They were told not to even tell Lyndon Johnson of its existence. That, of course, did lead to a very awkward morning 2.5 years later when Kennedy lay dead in Dallas and Lyndon Johnson was president. He came into office not knowing this existed, and it took a very delicate conversation by the director of Central Intelligence to come in that morning to show him the checklist and to just subtly pretend like this was a presidential prerogative. Johnson was no dummy, and he probably knew that he had been shut out of this, as he had been from other discussions during the Kennedy White House.
Is it customary now for vice presidents to receive a copy of the PDB?
Absolutely. In the vast majority of cases since, the vice president has been a regular customer of the PDB. Usually the dissemination has included the president, the national security advisor, the secretaries of state and defense, and the vice president. Other administrations have added people depending on their portfolios, depending on the style of the president himself. A few administrations have pared it back just a little bit to just include people at the White House, but generally that is the core group.
At what point do presidential candidates or presidents-elect start to receive documents that either are the PDB or resemble the president's daily brief?
The PDB traditionally has been reserved for after the election. And at some point soon after the election, most presidents have authorized the CIA, and then in the last 10 years, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, which has taken over the president's daily brief process, to start briefing the president-elect on the PDB. But there are intelligence sessions that happen even before that, going all the way back to Truman again. Truman became president, and he did not even know of the Manhattan Project to create the atomic bomb.
Wow.
FDR had kept him out of the loop. Truman thought that this was unconscionable, and he vowed that his successors would not be in the same position. So in the 1952 election, he offered to the two major party candidates intelligence briefings after the nominating conventions, but before the election, to make sure that if they had to take over suddenly, that they would not be starting from ground zero. That tradition has stuck. In fact, all of the candidates from the major parties since that time have been offered intelligence briefings. Most of them have accepted, but those briefings are overviews of the hotspots around the world and some of the other pressing intelligence issues. They do not include the most sensitive analysis and reporting that has been included in the president's daily book of secrets.
So to make sure that I'm clear on this, it's essentially a really good summary of what is happening, but not sensitive information until someone has been elected president of the United States.
Right. We should note it is still classified information. It is still top secret, the highest classification in the U.S. government, but it does not necessarily include compartmented programs or ones that are walled off even from people within the intelligence community. Certainly doesn't include a lot of attention to covert action programs or things like that. The pre-election briefings tend to focus on a snapshot of the world, including classified reporting and analysis. After the election, that's when the president-elect is brought into the circle of the current president's daily brief.
My guest is David Preece. He was a daily intelligence briefer for the CIA to Presidents Bill Clinton and George W. Bush, and also served as a desk officer at the State Department. His new book is called The President's Book of Secrets, The Untold Story of Intelligence Briefings to America's Presidents from Kennedy to Obama. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. You can email think at kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with David Preece, who was a daily intelligence briefer for the CIA to Presidents Bill Clinton and George W. Bush, and a desk officer at the State Department. His new book is called The President's Book of Secrets, The Untold Story of Intelligence Briefings to America's Presidents from Kennedy to Obama. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. David, how much of the president's daily brief is devoted to describing current events, and under what circumstances might it offer analysis or even make predictions about things?
Yeah, Chris, the book is a book of analysis. It may include just some factual descriptions or some raw intelligence reporting, that is, the information coming in directly from intelligence sources. But at its core, the president's daily brief is a book of assessments. Often it is likened to a jigsaw puzzle that is not complete. That is, there is an image there, and there are various pieces of it from intelligence reporting and even open sources, but the overall image isn't perfectly complete. And it's up to the analysts writing it and the editors putting the polishing touches on it to try to say, this is what the image probably is. This is probably what is happening overseas, either a threat to U.S. interests or an opportunity for U.S. action based on what we know, what we don't know, and the logic and history that pertains to this account. So most of it is the best judgment of the intelligence community as presented to the president on the issues of the day.
And the intelligence community, you know, has had some successes and some failures with this,
sure.
Sort of nailed the duration of the Six-Day War.
Yeah, in 1967, there were reports coming in the several weeks before that talking very clearly about the fact that Egypt's president was probably going to try to amplify the tensions between Israel and Syria and broaden them into a regional war. That did end up developing, and near the beginning of it, the CIA analyst predicted that it probably would be over within a week, and sure enough, it became known as the Six-Day War.
Hmm. President Johnson was not initially interested in things that had been custom designed for his predecessor. Can you talk about how the president's daily brief evolved, even in terms of its name, under Johnson?
Yeah, as we mentioned, with John F. Kennedy, he had this president's intelligence checklist, and he had excluded Johnson from it. So probably as he's reading this early on, Johnson realizes this ain't for him. You know, this is for the previous president. Hmm. And as it goes along, he's reading it, but it's not really catching with him. His advisors are troubled. The CIA leaders are troubled because they're not really connecting with the new president. So it only took them until December of 1964, a little over a year later, when they decided that they would give Johnson something that he could truly call his own. What they did is they reformatted the president's intelligence checklist. They put it in a slightly different style. They renamed it. They called it the President's Daily Brief, and they started delivering it at night because Lyndon Johnson liked to do a whole lot of his paperwork sitting in bed late at night. And there would be a huge stack, sometimes a foot tall, of various memos and action items, and he would go through them systematically into the wee hours of the morning, and they started delivering the President's Daily Brief to Lyndon Johnson in the afternoon so that it would make that night reading stack.
Doesn't it seem like it would be hard to sleep after reading the president's daily brief?
There are certainly things in there that do not make human nature look good. A lot of the times the reporting and the analysis in the book is about the world's trouble spots. And the president of the United States can only do so much about every trouble spot around the world. But on the other hand, as I mentioned, sometimes there are opportunities identified there. And it may be that some of the analysis in the book gives the president an idea of something that can be done to advance U.S. interests abroad. The funny thing about Johnson was he would make those marks right at the moment, and in the morning, when the chief of staff would come into his bedroom and go through the night reading stack with him, he would have orders ready to be issued out to people based on what he'd read as he went to bed in the wee hours of the morning.
Wow. Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Becky on the line in Louisville. Hello, Becky.
Hi, thank you guys so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question. How exactly is it decided who gets to know what classified information and when?
Great question, Becky. The information that gets into the president's daily brief is actually a little bit easier than at other levels of the U.S. government. Because depending on people's position as a secretary of a department or as an assistant secretary within a department, Sometimes it's a tough call, and it is a judgment call who gets what level. Most people in national security positions at various levels in the main departments that play in national security, State Department, Defense Department, Treasury Department, they certainly have the security clearances to view a wide range of information. But what they need to know on a particular day might be a matter of judgment. The president's daily brief is pretty easy because the president can see everything. There is nothing that can't be put into the president's daily brief if the president has decided that that is the vehicle that he or she wants to use to receive that information. Now, traditionally, there have been people who have decided there are some things we'd rather just tell the president in person because we think that it's something so sensitive, perhaps the name or the exact position of a very sensitive human source overseas in a foreign government. And that's okay. That works as well, as long as the president gets the information he or she needs to know when he or she needs to know it.
And different presidents over time have valued those face-to-face briefings over the printed document or vice versa.
Right. And this has been one of the most interesting parts of the research that I did, talking to all of the living former presidents, all of the living former vice presidents, and about 100 or so of the top national security officials from the last several decades. I found that the difference between presidents in terms of how they received information was dramatic. Some read the PDB daily, and they wrote notes on it, and that got information back to those who needed to act on it. Some of them probably read the PDB, but without making a lot of notes in it, it's unknown exactly how much they valued it. And then some presidents, notably Gerald Ford in the first year of his administration, and George H.W. Bush throughout his administration of 4 years, and then his son, George W. Bush, for a full 8 years, they actually sat down every working day with a CIA working-level intelligence officer who not only talked through some of the pieces in the daily book, but also was there to answer questions from the president, was there to discuss alternative assessments to what was on the page, or to drill deeper on related issues. It's a higher level of engagement with the intelligence than reading it alone might bring.
How much engagement did President Nixon have with the people preparing the president's daily brief?
President Nixon is an enigma, and that's true in so many ways right. across his administration, and it does not stop with the president's daily brief. In trying to research this, it was difficult because the papers of the Nixon Library do not give much of a spotlight into Nixon's reaction to the book. We have some insight from the way he handled it as president-elect. The CIA had set up in New York near his transition offices the first full-time support hub to support an incoming administration that the CIA had ever done. And there were officers up there whose duty was to brief incoming senior national security position holders, but also to get the president's daily brief to the president-elect. And what they did is they would deliver in sealed envelopes the president's daily brief copies to the president's or the president-elect's secretary. And then they found over time that he simply wasn't opening them and reading them. In fact, when the transition office closed, they received back all of those envelopes, apparently unopened. That was a sign of things to come, because even though the president's daily brief was going to the White House every day while Nixon was president, and Henry Kissinger, his national security advisor, certainly read it carefully and engaged with it, we don't have any direct evidence that Nixon paid exceptionally close attention to it because he was such a private person, such a closed-off person. We don't know the extent to which he enjoyed the material in it or read it at all.
So, I mean, if Nixon asked Kissinger to brief him on what was important, that gave Kissinger a lot of power.
Absolutely. And this has been the habit of a few presidents, to allow the national security advisor to take all of the inputs coming into the White House and decide what the president really needs to know. And there's some logic behind that. The person in the national security advisor's position usually has an office down the hall from the president, is in on all of the National Security Council meetings, understands what the needs of the president are. On the other hand, it is generally a good idea for the president to have an objective source of information apart from the policy inputs, and the national security advisor usually does have an opinion about the policy inputs coming from other departments. Traditionally, the intelligence services have played this role to provide an objective and hopefully accurate view of the world situation to allow the president to get that objective point of view.
What can you tell us about President Ford's engagement with the brief?
President Ford took it up a notch, and it was due to a little dash of deception by the director of Central Intelligence at the time that he became vice president. He came in for Richard Nixon, and he came to the CIA for a visit. And as he was being toured around, taken to meetings and briefings, the director of Central Intelligence happened to walk him into what was called the Office of Current Intelligence. And that's the office at CIA that was producing the president's daily brief and other documents. And as he walked in, he saw some documents sitting on a table. One of them was the president's daily brief. And he said, wow, what's that? Apparently, he had not been seeing it in his time as vice president. And the director told him what it was and said, would you like to see it? And of course, the vice president said yes. And they set up a system whereby a senior officer from the CIA would go to Vice President Ford's house and deliver the PDB to him and talk through its content. Ford loved it. In fact, when he inherited the Oval Office just a few months later upon Nixon's resignation, he was the first president to bring that briefer with him. And that same officer started seeing Gerald Ford every day in the Oval Office to talk through the PDB. He did that for his first year in office. After that, he felt good enough on the intelligence and national security issues. He continued to read the PDB every day, but he just didn't get the in-person briefing every day.
President Carter was one who preferred to have information delivered to him by a staff member.
That's right. The national security advisor in that case was Zbigniew Brzezinski, and he followed the example that Henry Kissinger had had back in the Nixon administration, where he consolidated the control under himself. In fact, a couple of months after Jimmy Carter took office, he finally got his director of Central Intelligence, Admiral Stansfield Turner, confirmed. Stansfield Turner came in, saw that the president was actively engaging with his PDB, scrawling comments in the margins, seemingly having an active dialogue with its producers via the written comments on the page. And he thought, well, I'm the president's chief intelligence advisor. Shouldn't I be going every morning to present him this intelligence? So he confronted the national security advisor with this. The national security advisor had been giving the PDB to the president along with his other national security information. Turner said to Brzezinski, I probably should be doing this. I'm the president's chief intelligence advisor. I should deliver the intelligence briefings. Brzezinski went over to the president's calendar, scratched out the words intelligence briefing, and wrote in national security briefing and considered the matter closed. He would continue handling all of this information.
Wow. How is the document kept secure? I would think, I mean, it's not like people are leaving things lying around, but if this is printed material, what are the rules for White House staffers about if they happen to lay eyes on a document like this? Are they required to sort of report that they saw something they shouldn't see?
Sure. In various administrations, they've had different approaches, but the core has remained the same. The copies of the president's daily brief are taken by intelligence officers directly to the customers. In some cases, it's left with the customer so they can read it at their leisure. And in that case, yes, maybe it could float around and other eyes could see it. In most cases, it's more controlled than that. The extreme of control was under President George H.W. Bush. He'd come in, he had been director of Central Intelligence, and he had been vice president for 8 years. He knew about the security of the information in the president's daily brief. What he did is he told everyone who received it, that included his Secretary of State, his Secretary of Defense, I believe the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff was a customer by then as well, he told all of them that they must follow the same pattern that he himself followed. The CIA briefer would come in, would deliver the president's daily brief, would go over it with you, answer questions, and then you would give your copy of the book back to the briefer. The president typically followed that practice even in the Oval Office, handing the copy of the book back to the briefer to maintain security of the document, and he insisted that all of his senior officers do the same.
President Reagan's briefing sometimes included video clips?
Absolutely. Several presidents had done this. I found reference to Richard Nixon getting a video of Soviet leader Brezhnev, and Ford and Carter also enjoyed movies to supplement the material in the written product. Reagan, being a man of the movies himself, certainly enjoyed this as well, but it's funny, the conventional wisdom holds it that Reagan really wasn't much of a reader, so he must have taken the information solely through videos, or mostly through videos at least. But in fact, an examination of the first 1,000 or so of Reagan's PDBs that a CIA historian did showed that Reagan made markings or notations in quite a few of them, often checks and brackets, occasionally underlying misspellings or errors in the text, even making little remarks and questions. These are not the signs of someone who did not read the book carefully.
We've learned so much subsequent to the assassination attempt on Reagan's life about how very close he came to dying. He was not reading the reports for a couple of weeks while he was in the hospital. Is that right?
That's right. He was quite close to death. In fact, the book Rawhide Down by Dale Quentin Wilbur does an amazing job of showing, using some inside information there, about just how dire the situation was. His advisors would see him, but they would try to keep substantive issues from troubling him unless they were absolutely necessary. And one of those was the president's daily brief. It was after he returned to the White House that they finally decided to start giving him the document back. A funny story there. On one of those first days, the national security advisor took the president's daily brief up to the residence where Reagan was recuperating and started to hand it to the president. And he could see from the look in the president's eyes that he didn't really want to go through this. So the national security advisor gave him the book, waited half a second, then reached over, took the book back, and said, "Mr. President, you've had your briefing today." Reagan smiled, thought this was great, and then he noticed the bulge under the national security advisor's arm. And he said, "Dick, what's that?" He said, "Nothing, sir. Nothing to trouble you with." He goes, "Dick, what is it?" And his national security advisor, Dick Allen, said, "Sir, those are just a bunch of get-well cards from my daughter's kindergarten class in Arlington. I promised I would bring them into the briefing, but I won't trouble you." Reagan said, "Which one is your daughter's?" He said, "Sir, don't worry about it. Which one is your daughter's?" He had to produce the card that his daughter had written. In fact, Reagan ended up going through all of the get-well cards that all of the kindergartners had drawn and written for him, and he wrote a special message on the one from Dick Allen's daughter, and I include a picture of that in the book, courtesy of Dick Allen, showing that he did take care to write a message back to those who had sent him these personal get-well wishes.
We're speaking this hour with David Preece, who served as daily intelligence briefer for the CIA to Presidents Bill Clinton and George W. Bush. His new book is called The President's Book of Secrets, The Untold Story of Intelligence Briefings to America's Presidents from Kennedy to Obama. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find me on Twitter. I'm at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with a former daily intelligence briefer for the CIA to Presidents Bill Clinton and George W. Bush, David Preece. His new book is called The President's Book of Secrets, The Untold Story of Intelligence Briefings to America's Presidents from Kennedy to Obama. David, you worked on the book for Presidents Bill Clinton and George W. Bush. How did their engagement with security and international affairs differ, and how did that play out in what appeared in their briefs and how they followed up with them?
Sure. First, let me clarify one thing. I worked at the CIA for President Clinton and President Bush. I was not the briefer for either of them directly.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification.
I did brief the president's daily brief to some of the people that George W. Bush designated to receive it. So I did work on that briefing team. But being aware of it from both of their administrations and from the research I did talking to the vast majority of people who did receive it during both administrations, it was a different approach. Bill Clinton was, by all accounts, a people person. He liked talking to people. He liked engaging in things. He liked really digging into a conversation. What happened was, early in his administration, they tried to have a regular PDB briefing, as they had done for his predecessor, Bush 41. Very quickly, they discovered this just wasn't working because the briefing was getting postponed due to earlier meetings going long, or the PDB session itself went long and postponed other important meetings with visiting heads of state or important other visitors. Eventually, what happened is they just stopped doing regular briefings. The president continued to read it very carefully. He told me he always got something out of the PDB every single day, but he didn't get the daily briefings that his predecessor had received. He told me he felt particularly well-served by the PDB, however. One example he talked to me about was in July 1999, when India and Pakistan were fighting along their border. The president had already read his daily book of secrets and was disturbed to see in it the assessment that India and Pakistan had imperfect knowledge about each other's nuclear intentions, meaning this crisis could easily spin out of control into a nuclear exchange. Clinton met with the Pakistani prime minister that day and confronted him, even asking the prime minister if he knew that his own military was preparing nuclear missiles for action. Clinton eventually persuaded the prime minister to pull Pakistani troops back from the brink, helping to prevent a nuclear war because of what was in the Book of Secrets that day.
Many Americans first became aware of the president's daily brief when it was revealed that President George W. Bush had received one with the headline, "Bin Laden Determined to Strike U.S." What can you tell us about that edition and how it was received and understood in the context of the reports that preceded and followed it before the 9/11 attacks actually took place?
Yeah, there had been growing attention to terrorism as a topic in the president's daily brief. Certainly starting in the 1970s, there were reports going to the president on the topic. But it really escalated in the late 1990s with the rise of Al-Qaeda. So Bill Clinton was getting plenty of information about terrorism in the PDB, as was President George W. Bush before September 11th. Of course, after September 11th, even more so. But terrorism as a topic was in the book. That does not mean it was the book. The president's daily brief on an average day can cover 5, 6, 7, up to 10 different topics with analysis and reporting from the intelligence world. That's a lot of material, sometimes on countries on every continent, and sometimes things requiring action that day because of a meeting with a foreign leader or an upcoming summit. So when that piece, Bin Laden Determined to Strike in the U.S., came along, it was on the heels of other terrorism pieces that had been close to that topic. There had been plenty of other material making it into the White House at the lower levels about the plans and intentions of Al-Qaeda. The one thing that piece did not do is predict the actual attacks of 9/11. Because it did mention an airplane hijacking, however, it received a whole lot of attention from the 9/11 Commission, which investigated the heck out of it. And it certainly brought attention to this daily book of secrets that was going to the president every day.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Greta on the line in Plano. Hi, Greta.
Hi, Diane. Nice to talk to you.
It's Chris, but nice to talk to you, too.
I'm sorry, Chris. I'm so sorry.
That's okay.
My question is, since you said George W. Bush went through things very carefully with his advisor concerning the president's daily briefing, what is it about the weapons of mass destruction? Some people think that that was just, that was, you know, misleading, that he was misleading people. On the other hand, was it true that there were, that he was advised there were weapons of mass destruction?
What can you tell us about that, David?
Yeah, the exhaustive WMD Commission explored and actually rejected some pundits' claims that intelligence officers were lying about Iraq's unconventional weapons or just told policymakers what they wanted to hear. They found that the analysts producing for all kinds of intelligence reporting, including the president's daily brief, simply got it wrong. They inadvertently misled policymakers in both the daily intelligence and longer form products with incorrect analysis that was not ill-intentioned. It was just plain wrong. George Tenet has said this about as clearly as anyone. He said, "Even though the daily reports the president saw in the run-up to the production of the National Intelligence Estimate on Iraq's weapons of mass destruction were uneven and assertive in tone, and at times more assertive on some issues than the National Intelligence Estimate, they were a reflection of honest analysis." So the conclusion of those who were looking at this, exactly with this question in mind, wrote to Bush that they found no indication that the intelligence community distorted the evidence regarding potential Iraqi WMD. What they told him about Saddam Hussein's programs was what they believed. They were just wrong.
How has the creation of the PDB changed since that time and since its production specifically was handed over to the Office of the Director of National Intelligence?
Right. In April of 2005, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence was created in part because of the investigations after 9/11 and the Iraq WMD case. The powers that be decided that there needed to be a new structure to integrate elements of the intelligence community, and they gave to that new entity control of the president's daily brief process. From all of those I spoke with in the Bush administration about what happened at that point, most of them said, steady as she goes. President George W. Bush liked his intelligence briefings. He was still giving them plenty of time every day. And so they made some changes, but overall, it did not change the core elements of the product he was receiving. In fact, when I asked him about what issues he had noticed when the PDB shifted to management of the DNI, Bush said none. I don't remember seeing any changes because the CIA analysts were still the briefers.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Ed on the line in Arlington. Hello, Ed.
Hi, Mr. Priest. I'm wondering if you can comment on the specific contents of the intelligence's presidential daily briefings during the Johnson and Nixon eras, specifically regarding the Vietnam War. I've always been struck why we fought that war entirely on a defensive battle and never mounted an invasion of North Vietnam to topple their leadership, and I have understood that to be because we were afraid of what that might do to our relationship with China and Russia and what the consequences of their getting involved, their response to that, such an action of our part might be. Can you comment on what the briefings contained about the potential?
Sure, Ed. Thank you. The issue of Vietnam is, of course, a thorny one for many reasons. When it comes to the president's daily brief, the president was getting information about Vietnam and its context in the intelligence assessments there. He was also getting a special Vietnam supplement. That is, he was such an avid reader of things having to do with Vietnam, and I'm talking about President Johnson here, virtually consumed his second term, that he was getting a whole lot of material on it. The engagement in Vietnam, of course, started earlier, and President Kennedy had started some of the buildup that Johnson inherited. But Johnson, of course, took it to a new level. The fact is, when there is a policy that is that deeply ingrained, and it can be Vietnam in the late 1960s, it can be the war in Iraq in 2004, 2005, 2006, the president is getting no shortage of inputs. In fact, there may be too much information coming in. The issue is what he decides to do with it. And that's really a separate question than the provision of the intelligence itself. Looking at that, I can direct you to the documents themselves, because late last year, for the first time in history, the intelligence community and the administration decided to start declassifying and releasing many of the old copies of the president's intelligence checklist and president's daily brief. So the vast majority of those documents that were going to the president's eyes from the 1960s to both Kennedy and Johnson are now available on the CIA website, and you can see them with minor redactions, still protecting sources and methods that are relevant to today. But otherwise, all that information is out there and available for viewing.
What remarkable depth they must add to mm-hmm. a historical study of, you know, the headlines from the time and sort of recognizing, you know, how a president, having seen those briefs, took action based on them.
Right. The shocking thing for me is we tend to look at these things going backward. We tend to look at these things as, well, how could they not have realized this? There was an analysis in the president's daily brief for President Johnson that said North Vietnam is going to try to create the illusion of a war no one can win. And the war went on for many years afterwards, which looked exactly like that. Looking back, it's easy to look at that one article and that one quote as how didn't this slap the president across the face and wake him up? But then when you look at the totality of it, when you look at the entire document that is in front of him, along with all of those other papers in that foot-high stack of reading, you realize there were also crises going on in the Middle East. There were also things going on in Africa. There was also issues directly with the Soviet Union, with European allies, with Latin America. There are no shortage of crises and potential crises hitting the president's desk every day, and we should be wary about looking to one piece of paper with one article, with one paragraph, with one sentence that should have been an alarm bell for the president when it's in the stream of this huge flow of information that goes to the Oval Office every day.
How well does the president's daily brief translate in digital form?
Well, it's interesting you ask that because that is a recent development. Traditionally, the PDB has been an ink-on-paper document. That's true back to the 1960s, all the way up until a few years ago. Then President Obama started receiving it on an iPad. Suddenly it was electrons on a screen instead of ink on the printed page. That is a different form, of course, It allows different things in terms of manipulating things with your fingers, incorporating multimedia graphics, showing videos right there within the document. But the analysis largely remains the same. You're still taking an incomplete picture overseas, pulling together relevant information, and trying to explain something that is largely hidden from open view. That is true whether it's words on a page or words on a screen.
What can you tell us about how intelligence officers are able to make known to their supervisors, who can make known to whoever is compiling the PDB, that they have something that they think is important enough for the president's consideration?
Sure. Over the course of the history and talking with both people who wrote for the president's daily brief and the senior managers up to and including the CIA directors who traditionally managed it, the process is remarkably similar across the years. Analysts at the working level would be looking at what's going on in their individual countries or individual functional areas and say, this is new and different. This is something that changes what we've told the president. And they would bring it up, and usually discussions with others inside the intelligence community would help them decide, is this something that needs to be brought to the president's attention today? If so, they'd write up a piece, put the analysis on it, get it ready. The president would see it. Of course, there's bureaucracy involved. So that means there's going to be people reviewing the product, coordinating on the product, editing the product, proofreading ultimately the product, and deciding, is this worth showing to the president? And if it is, what's the best format for doing so? Is it a long article with a lot of explanation and depth? Or in some cases, some of the presidents received parts of their PDB in what they called snowflake form, which were little short sentences or two, just with quick updates on issues, without the depth that was needed, but just to make sure the president was up to speed on things. All of that is produced, put together, presented to the president, and then either in written form or in oral form, if the president is getting briefed, there's some feedback on whether this material was useful, and hopefully the process leads to a learning process where the president is even better served in the future.
Is there such a thing as a PDB style guide in the manner of an AP style guide?
Yeah, there is a style guide for intelligence publications. In fact, one was declassified and put out there on the internet not too long ago. And you can actually look at some of the style considerations that go into producing intelligence documents. The one thing that's true about that style guide, more so than any other one that I've encountered, is the emphasis on clarity and concise writing. There is no premium greater than the one that is placed on ensuring there are no misunderstandings. And that makes sense if you think about it, because if you're presenting something to the President of the United States who might take action with the armed forces, you want to make sure that it's not misunderstood. That is number one. Concise is important because this is the President of the United States. His or her time is measured to the minute. You have to be concise, or the president isn't going to have time to read it.
David Preece is a veteran of the CIA and the State Department. His new book is called The President's Book of Secrets, The Untold Story of Intelligence Briefings to America's Presidents from Kennedy to Obama. David, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for making time for us.
You're welcome.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy, with help on the phones today from Alex Smith. Samantha Guzman is associate producer and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.